In other words, it's man really in this case, and his conduct, which standardizes morality. And thus, and this, by the way, of course, is something which we are so familiar with in Western culture. In place of a sacerdotal hierarchy, Orthodox Islam has ever looked to the political sovereign for the direction of Muslim affairs, not excluding imposition of sanctions for breach of Quranic precepts, and interpreting these precepts by civil decree. Now this is to be stated, and it is verified in over 1,000 years of Muslim history. In other words, and to repeat, it is not a question of union of church and state in Islam. The church, understand now, Islamic community, is the state in Islam. And this, of course, it's as though Christ himself, suppose, and this is, I think, a good comparison, suppose Christ in our religion had been the Roman emperor, or had moved to Rome with an army, as, by the way, Peter did, and talk about all kinds of comparisons can be made, the way Islam began, the way Christianity began. Peter, too, went very soon to the center of the then political world. In this case, he moved west. Yet instead of starting an army, instead of using the sword, well, he happened not to die by the sword. It was Paul, wasn't it? Peter was crucified. And again, if you see the difference in approach, now it is as though instead of Peter going to Rome, Christ had gone to Rome. And instead of doing what Peter had done, namely, preaching the gospel, getting himself clamped up in jail, miraculously escaping, just to whet his appetite, and to give him a little more chance of breather, then getting himself cut down, Christ had gone to Rome, mustered an army, unseated Augustus, and had told all and sundry, ladies and gentlemen, you don't know it, but we've got a new religion on the horizon. It's called Christianity, named after me. Now, suppose that had been true. So the Gospels, of course, would be quite different. And the references, by the way, to the sword, and there are at least two passages where Christ speaks of the sword, remember? And in both cases, remember who is concerned, sisters? Peter. What eloquent commentaries could be written on that? You see the difference? Christ was an Oriental. He knew the Oriental tendency to join ideas with action. Peter was an authentic Oriental. So, his idea of propagating Christianity was, well, with a scabbard next to him and, of course, sheathing a sharpened sword. And he was told, Peter, cut it out. That's not the kind of religion you're supposed to propagate. You see the contrast, and I think this bears much more relationship or comparison. And the reason is because when political power gets into seat of authority or autonomy, this is basically what it does, and of course, religions, and insofar as they depart from the teachings of Christ, and Christians have not been unknown to use political power for their own ends. At any rate, let's see that when we're talking comparative religion, let's not be afraid to make comparisons. I'll tell my students. Why study comparative religion unless you're going to make comparisons? Now, marriage, divorce, and polygamy, a vast, uncharted sea for most people who are not Muslims. In the long years of its history, Islam has undergone many changes in its attitude on sex and marriage. notably on the emancipation of women in such countries as India and Pakistan, and the impracticality of polygamy on a large scale in modern society. They've discovered statistical laws which show that in most cultures over the centuries, the number of baby boys and baby girls coming into the world is almost the same, with a slightly higher ratio, just a matter of a couple of percent, for baby boys. And it seems the reason is they don't live as long as women. And polygamy, therefore, becomes a statistical impossibility on a large scale. Yet, basically, the principles enunciated in the Quran still remain in effect. And let's repeat it. They remain in effect. When the Constitution of Pakistan for 120 or so million says this Constitution is based on the Quran, and as we'll read in clear, beautiful passages, beautiful for the believing Muslim, about all of this, you see that this is not going out of vogue. And as more than one historian has pointed out, they most clearly distinguish Muslim culture from its Christian counterparts. Because whatever we've said so far, and you can see now how, along with what I made such pains with the time at my disposal to point out, the similarities, in some cases the identities, certainly on monotheism, between the Allah, whom the Muslims worship, and the God, and Yahweh, whom Jews and Christians worship, yet the differences begin to multiply. They are here in this matter of sex and marriage profoundly different. The Quran is extremely detailed on the subject of women's modesty, or more accurately, on their complete subservience and obscuration. They are bidden always to lower their gaze and not display their beauty, except, carefully provided, to husbands, fathers, and a restricted clientele of relatives and friends. Covering their faces with a veil was a practical carrying out of this basic injunction. I have here, and unfortunately I didn't have a chance, checking and getting the references all lined up and accurate takes a lot of time. 2430 is my text. Let's hope it's the correct text. 2430, and I guess following. See what it says about women. Well, it should say a lot about women, because it says a lot about marriage and so on. Say to the believing men, that they should lower their gaze and guard their modesty. That will make for greater purity for them, and God is well acquainted with all that they do. Now, there is a very simple injunction for the men. And say to the believing women, that they should lower their gaze and guard their modesty. That they should not display their beauty and ornaments, except what must ordinarily appear thereof. That they should draw their veils over their bosoms, and not display their beauty except, and I did get the text, to their husbands, their fathers, their husbands, fathers, their sons, their husbands' sons, their brothers, or their brothers' sons. Talk about details, sisters. Muhammad left nothing to the imagination. Or their sisters' sons, all their own women, that is, I presume, the women that are about them, or the slaves whom their right hand possess, or male servants free of physical need, that's a euphemism, or small children who have no sense of the shame of sex, that too is a euphemism, and they should not strike their feet in order to draw attention to their hidden ornaments. O you believers, turn you all together towards God, that you may attain bliss. You see, sisters, Muhammad seems to have known something about, shall I say, Oriental women. A father has the right to give a virgin daughter in marriage to whomever he pleases. In all marriages, the formal contracting parties are not the bride and groom, and this is simply part of the same attitude. But their fathers are responsible male relatives. The mothers don't even come in on the deal. Indeed, the marriage of a woman without the intervention of a qualified male relative is invalid. And to repeat, when Pakistan in 1967 holds that the laws are those of the Quran, this is the interpretation of the law of the Quran. And where no such relatives exist, his office is filled by a Gadi, G-A-D-I, a gentleman who, for a fee, takes care of finding an appropriate woman for a man for whom he is agent. And I'm told there are Gadis who are professional matchmakers, shall we call them? Muslim men may marry a Christian or a Jewish woman, but Muslim women do not enjoy the same liberty. I've got a number of texts that I will quote. Let's go over the. I want to first maybe give you, as I've mentioned, the summary of this as I have it, and then pull out some texts. First, marriages do not debar a man from further unions, since polygamy is legal. Also, outside the married state, a husband may cohabit with an unlimited number of concubines. This is not directly provided for by the Muslims, that is in the Quran, I should say, but it is practiced by Muslims. And let me just state this, that inasmuch as polygamy is directly authorized by the Quran, and polygamy, and the more cultures become stratified and non-nomadic, in fact, polygamy was unquestionably permitted by, if not prescribed, by the Quran, because in Muhammad's time it was still a very nomadic, mobile society. As a society becomes more and more stable, practical polygamy becomes understandably more difficult. For one thing, the women available have already been married, and the man who loves the wife that he has will scarcely want to share her with somebody else. So there are all sorts of, you see, inner limitations on polygamy as a society becomes stabilized. One of the finest counterparts to what happened to Islam on this very important level of polygamy is to see what happened to the Mormons in the United States. And just doing some work recently and completely realizing my own first book on the Protestant churches after 10 years, Protestantism is just a new religion in the United States. I had to completely revise my section on Mormonism. And as a consequence, went back to certain texts that I hadn't seen before and so on. And I've discovered that there's a growing amount of good literature on the Mormons. As you know, they still are polygamous. That is on principle. Joseph Smith, as far as we can tell, both practiced and preached polygamy. But as it became more stabilized in Utah, in Salt Lake City, by the end of the 19th century, which was less than, I think, Smith was murdered in 1942 or 1906, it got to a point where the Supreme Court, as you may recall, passed judgment on the constitutionality of a law, a federal law, disfranchising completely, in other words, depriving the right of citizenship, the holding of office, to anyone in the United States who professes and practices polygamy. And by that time, Utah had capitulated. And mainly because it was already, you see, within Utah itself, having become, really, it was just a Mormon state. And this is interesting, and for you, women would be very illuminative to see, for example, the petitions, the movements formed by women's suffrage of a kind that we know so little about, and yet this is American history, as it really was, the Utah women organizing to protect themselves, you see, against the polygamy which was built into, say, the Book of Mormon. I bring that out to compare it now with one type of religion which we are very familiar with, and that as Islam becomes more stabilized, immobilized, and by the way, the word state should never be forgotten, that it comes from the Latin status, which is the adversative to motus. You know what I'm saying? In other words, it is a stabilized society. Now, it isn't just me that people stay put because they can move around, but there's a center of gravity, see? There's a geographical limitation within which they, in general, live, to which they owe allegiance and loyalty, where they pay their taxes, where they have authority, which is somehow territorialized. You see what we're talking about. And this has profound implications for the whole concept of society, community, and so on. At any rate, in this context, the laws of marriage, therefore, and especially to do something about the promiscuity which Muhammad saw all around him. He stabilized it as far as he thought he could. He wouldn't dare monogamy. He thought, this is good to remember, though he dared to preach monotheism, he didn't dare preach monogamy. He knew the limitations of the human nature that he knew, beginning with his own. Outside the married state, therefore, a husband may cohabit with an unlimited number of concubines. And wherein, of course, this is the problem and this is the difficulty that Muslims have. And I talk to them, heart to heart. If they're caught within, you might say, the web of their own religion, where it teaches polygamy, and if you tell them, well, look, I respect what Muhammad did. I think he did a good thing. And I thank God for it. Better polygamy than promiscuity. But remember, he was a man of his time. And if having four wives is better than having, or having intercourse with any woman available, and if, and I believe he was under some kind of divine guidance, I do, then maybe in the divine plan, and I'm safe in saying this, monogamy was impossible. Even as I believe it was, at least psychologically speaking, for the Jews, for whom Christ himself, remember, in Matthew says, this is allowed you. Now Christ might have said, all those beginning with Abraham who had more than one wife were sinners. They will not enjoy the kingdom of God. He didn't say that. We're dealing, of course, with the substantive of the moral law, and we can't go into that here. So I tell them, remember that as Islam becomes stabilized and statified, so to speak, just ask yourself whether monogamy is not the answer for a society as a society develops a stabilized concept of community. What they're doing, of course, polygamy is a practical impossibility. Practical in the sense that available women are no longer available legitimately. So what do? They have concubines. Their children have the same status as those of wedded wives, and this, be it said, is provided even by Pakistan. The children, therefore, of concubines have the same legal status as of legal wives. Muhammad formally approved polygamy. He had several wives, and depending on the tradition, 9 according to one, 12 according to another, up to 14. But for his followers, he limited the number to 4, and he will read both passages. Tradition, therefore, has set the limits for ordinary believers to 4 wives, but it authorizes caliphs and sultans, as successors of the prophet, to have 9. the lowest traditional number that Mohammed had. Concubinage seems not to be anywhere directly sanctioned in the Quran, and the stringent Quranic laws against adultery intimate that the custom developed after Mohammed. The law against adultery, and by the way, when you read adultery in the Quran, it should really read, by our standards, concubinage. Because once you say that polygamy is allowable, you know, what happens to the word adultery? It takes on a brand new meaning, about the only meaning that it would have authentically, by our still sense of adultery, would be where, say, a man would have intercourse with another man's wife. But as far as having intercourse with other women besides his wife, well, that's provided for. In any case, polygamy is a costly luxury, so that only the rich can afford to practice it legitimately. For one thing, the legitimate wives cannot live together. This is beautifully provided for by Muhammad. Each must have a separate apartment and domestics. Men of moderate means usually, and quite obviously, cannot provide such accommodation. Divorced by the husband's repudiation of his wife is a privilege granted in the Quran. No intervention of any judicial authority is necessary, nor any assignment of reasons or justification, but a certificate of divorce, the get of rabbinic Judaism, must be given the wife. When I tell my students that the rabbinic word is, when you give your wife the get, you can but many will attest to that. However, the husband must wait 4 months before actually dismissing his spouse. Meantime, he must not cohabit with her, which is, by the way, a good sign that he really doesn't want her. And it's a pretty costly venture. Now that he's got 4 months to think it over. After a first repudiation, the wife may not be married for at least 3 months. Again, a wise provision. During which time she may be taken back without a further contract. So 4 months abstention from intercourse, by which time he will think this over many times, and then after he finally repudiated her, he's got 3 more months to ask himself, did I really want to get rid of her? The same holds after a second repudiation, but a third repudiation is irrevocable. Muhammad was no fool. No repudiation, that is irrevocable, unless the woman has in the meantime married and been divorced by another man. Then that's it. Then he doesn't tell her, Mabel or the Muslim equivalent, I made a mistake. And she would tell him, sorry, Jack, I found somebody else. That settles it then. She made up his mind for him. An ancient custom allows a triple repudiation to be made, and this is, of course, one of the dodges of Muslim law, allows a triple repudiation to be made at one and the same time, with corresponding effects of its irrevocability. A pause for a breath or a glass of water, and then he repudiates it a second time and a third time, and then it's irrevocable. So now that we finish this part and quote the passage, and then we'll take our break. A woman's right to divorce her husband is highly restricted. Otherwise than the man, she cannot repudiate her partner by declaration. One option in Pakistan, for example, is to reach an agreement with him, which is before the marriage. An agreement with him that the marriage should be dissolved on payment of compensation, which usually means the return of her dowry. In other words, she asks himself, or when she gives him this kind of a contract, she's interested. But at least her father thinks she's interested. But not to be stung or caught because of the risk, of course, the instability of this give to women, you can imagine. So she may well say that I will marry him, but not too many women, I'm told, can bargain that kind of a marriage, because a lot of men will say, well, no thanks. I want to marry a woman whom I can unmarry at will. And not, notice, as a marriage should be dissolved on the payment of a compensation, because the dowry may be very substantial, maybe her whole inheritance. And if she comes from a wealthy family, that can be a lot of money, which may be one of the reasons why he's marrying her. But if the price of marrying her is the contract of having to repay what he got for marrying her, you can imagine how unlikely he is to marry a woman who will set such a price on her head. Some Muslim jurists claim that compensation is void if the reason for dissolving the marriage is cruelty by your husband, but that, of course, has to be proved in a court of law. Another way open for the wife is to appeal to the court for annulment, the so-called FASK, F-A-S-K-H. On such grounds as a husband's incurable disease or failure to support. Anticipating difficulties, Muslim women nowadays often insert a clause in the marriage contract, and they're doing it more and more in Pakistan. And in Turkey they've been doing it for quite some time, which, as you know, is a Muslim secularized state. They insert a clause in the marriage contract laying down certain stipulations which, when broken, the husband is obliged to grant his wife a divorce. For centuries, now this is an important notation, for centuries the stipulation that a husband should not marry another wife was held to be invalid. Do you notice what he says? I don't think I have all of these in your mention in your notes, but the polygamy is Surah 4, verses 3 and so on. If you fear that you shall not be able just to deal justly with the orphans, marry women of your choice, two or three or four, but if you fear that you shall not be able to deal justly with them, then only one. In other words, the question of the limitations on how to deal with those then who would be bereft of their mother. That your right hand possess, that your right hand possess. And give the woman on marriage their dower as a free gift. But as they have their own good pleasure, remit any part of it to you, take it and enjoy it with right good cheer, and so on. On divorce, Surah 2, verses 228 and following. He's talking about divorce in various contexts. If their intention is firm for divorce, the 4 months period and so on we talked about, God hears and knows all things. Divorced women shall wait concerning themselves for 3 months period. So is it lawful for them to hide what God has created in their wombs, if they have faith in God in the last day, and their right hands have the better part to take them back. In that period, if they wish for reconciliation, and women shall have rights similar to the rights against them, according to what is equitable, but men have a degree of advantage over them, and God is exalted in power. 229. A divorce is only permissible twice. After that, the parties shall either hold together on equitable terms or separate with kindness. It is not lawful for you, men, to take back any gift of your wives, and so on. By that time, if a man wants to, he will, of course, practice either polygamy or, more commonly, concubinage.
This concludes the series of talks given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J., on comparative religions, on Oriental religions.